We're back again. This is Stuart Wolf with the BC Alberta Social Economy Research Alliance, and we're talking about some of the work that we've been doing in recent years related to the social economy and community economic development. With me now is Mike Lewis. Mike is actually the lead investigator, the instigator of BALTA, and he's also the executive director of the Canadian Centre for Community Renewal, which is the lead organization in BALTA and is a community-based organization, which makes BALTA different from a lot of these research networks that exist that are run out of universities and then liaise with community. This one actually sprung up starting in the community, but has brought strong university involvement into it. And what we're going to talk about with Mike is work he's been doing around something he calls sea change. So Mike, sea change. What is sea change and why should people care?
Sea change, is a metaphor for social, ecological, and economic. Prompted this is a growing awareness of the realities of climate change and peak oil and the implications those might have for our economies where we live.
I'm going to stop you for just one second there, Mike. Most people are familiar with climate change these days, at least the issue. Peak oil is a term that not everybody's familiar with, so maybe you could just briefly explain that one.
Well, peak oil will be familiar insofar as people can see the volatility in the oil price. And what it really represents is the fact that we have reached a plateau in exploiting the oil reserves on the planet. And that fines on an annual basis are declining 6.7% compared to the ongoing accelerating demand for oil as a major fueling of the global economy. So the basic debate that's been going on for the last 10 years in something called the peak oil forum is essentially, has peak oil arrived? Are we there? Is it next year? Is it 10 years from now? I think that if one looks at even the price of oil where it was in 2008, where it reached $147 a barrel, and then we hit recession big time, then it dropped to $34 a barrel in 3 months, and 3 months after that it was back up to $80 a barrel. The peak oil phenomena is one that is of concern, not only that oil is such a crucial part of generating the fuel for our cars, generating electricity, used for all kinds of manufactured products from plastics to agricultural products like pesticides, et cetera, mm-hmm. that trying to wean ourselves off the oil fix is a hugely problematic for all of us, no matter where we live.
Okay, thanks. I just wanted to make sure our listeners understood that, and so back to sea change.
Yeah, so sea change is basically saying, look, we got this crisis that's growing in terms of changing climate and in terms of the basis upon which our economies are fueled. How are we going to deal with this? Is it more of the same? Is it globalization ramped up another notch? How are we going to make this transition? So essentially, the first step in what we call sea change is that it's absolutely fundamental that we begin to see the world differently, that we begin to recognize and acknowledge that, in fact, we are outstripping our capacity to live in balance with this planet. In fact, we've already outstripped it. And thus our peripheral vision and our ability to see the relief of our planet and our place in it needs to shift. So that's the first step. Second step is that once we've seen things differently and we begin to get a sense of the relief of the landscape that we're having to work on in economic and social and political terms, and in environmental terms, we can begin to seek pathways that are strategic and begin to help us see paths through this difficult part of human history towards something that might have the potential for bringing us into balance. And the third thing is, if we have in fact got the beginnings of a number of alternative pathways and transition towards much less dependence on fossil fuel and thus much less carbon being emitted into the atmosphere, we need to also realize this is going to be a contentious process. There's a lot of folks that are not quite ready to give up the idea that we are going to be able to continue to guide ourselves into the future by looking through the rearview mirror.
And that's certainly an understatement.
That is an understatement. So it means that the thousands of people that are coalescing in all kinds of different ways in civil society, there's some hopeful signs and innovation going on in the private sector, and some governments that have got the picture a lot more clearly in focus than others, that we need to federate around a different vision of our economic life, and that we have to be able to contend around that politically with the rulemakers and the people that exercise economic power. So essentially, sea change is a metaphor, and it's also, kind of a three-step plan. However, that's a little too broad to constitute a plan in terms of what I've said thus far. What we have done in our work is really look at several areas associated with the most basic needs we have as human beings. One is energy, one is food, one is shelter, and one is finance. And what we've done is we've kind of scoured the globe looking for strategic pathways, pioneers, trailblazers, if you will, that are showing us a way forward. And as we look at the context in food, for instance, which is going to become more and more a difficult problem for all of us, we've looked at where are people actually making real progress in reconstructing food systems that are more local and regional, that are utilizing ecological, low fossil fuel inputs, and are taking care of soil, and are paying a fair price to farmers. So we've looked, for instance, and done, it's within the book as one of the examples, the Saikatsu Cooperative in Japan. An amazing evolution in 40 years from a group of women that were concerned about nutrition, safety, farmers leaving the land, fair price, and ecological values, going to a farmer and saying, this is what we want in our food supply. Would you work with us to produce that kind of food that met those kinds of standards? And to make a long story short, he said, yes, you organize the market and provide me with a contract at a price that allows me to meet those standards, and I will produce for you. Today, that particular beginning has evolved into $1 billion a year cooperative enterprise that involves 120,000 of those kinds of groups.
A billion.
Yeah, $1 billion a year. And that's just a small piece of what's become a bigger story, but I won't go into that now. So this is a problem we all face. They face it here in New Brunswick. They face it anywhere in this country you go. Actually reconstructing markets and flows of product from local producers who hopefully would have sufficient confidence in that market to actually make the shift creates a challenge for all of us, because we have to become co-producers of a new food system. If we rely and continue to think that we're going to import and export food at the level we are now, we're sadly mistaken in my view. And one of the problems that brings us to, for instance, the question of how do we federate, because there's a lot of interest in local food all over this country. And there is a national food security network. But I think we're still a ways away from federating in a way that will actually build some of the policy changes we also need from governments who tend to be still very oriented toward export, oil-based, commodity agriculture in this country. That will not sustain us very well and leaves us very vulnerable in our local areas. So that's just kind of one area, and each of these chapters that deal with these specific basic needs, we've elevated really, really compelling experience. One of the most interesting, you know, for kind of a rural, kind of semi-rural district municipality in Sweden called Kristianstad. It's in the southeast, lowest lying part of Sweden. And the largest town is 33,000, but there's another 25 towns in this district municipality that extend from 33,000 to 150. And in 1999, the political leadership in this district municipality made a major decision on what has become a major priority, which is to become fossil fuel free. There is no other municipality that I know of anywhere in the world that has made that declaration as of 2011, except Kristianstad. They have two really interesting organizations that they own, both companies. One's a waste management utility, and one's a utility, electrical utility. Really interesting organizations, eh? Oh, yeah, they're really exciting and sexy. Anyway, what they've been able to do is they've been able to get to a point where 50% of their electricity for the entire region, 1,100 square kilometers, is fed off of biogas. There is also a lot of district heating that is fed by biofuels, which are wood chips and so on. The biogas, in case people don't know what that is a combination of the use of human waste and agricultural waste and using it in order to create methane, which, if it goes into the atmosphere, is about 21 times worse than carbon, but that, in fact, can be used as fuel. And they have also installed 100 megawatts, that's a lot of megawatts, in wind energy as of 3 years ago, and they are targeting 500 megawatts of electrical generation just by wind. They have solar. They've converted all of their district municipality fleet of vehicles, trucks, garbage trucks, cars, everything, to biogas, right? So it's an example of what can be done and, in a sense, what we need to be thinking about doing wherever we live. And I could go on and on and on. There's many, many pieces to this. One of the key things, though, is that you got to finance this.
That's always the big question.
And you have to have land, right? And you have to have ways in which you can access finance and land. And these are two key areas that also are part of what we've been researching and writing about. One of the big issues that a lot of Canadians recognize very, very personally is affordability at the household level. I bet you a lot of the students here have their own affordability problems. Yeah. We look at another Swedish example, actually, called the JAK Cooperative Bank. J-A-K stands for Land, Labor, Capital. Sounds like a socialist plot, doesn't it? In any case, they have an absolute philosophical disgust with compound interest because it makes housing so unaffordable, because it outstrips a lot of projects or excludes a lot of projects that could have ecological and social values because the cost of finance is too high. and it is driving the economic growth paradigm. It is one of the key drivers of the economic growth paradigm. You always got to make that much more profit in order to deal with your financing costs. So what they do is called fee-based financing. And so they have a membership fee for being part of the cooperative. They have a 1% fee, right, for an administrative fee, right? And I can't remember just now what the other 1% is, but it averages out to 2.5%. Now, that may not seem so great given how far our financing levels have been, but if you remember that in the last 30 years, the average cost of a mortgage has been 10.4%, and you look at the difference, it's huge.
So they do they do mortgages and things like that as well?
Yeah, they really started mainly in trying to create a solidarity-based finance system which would allow people to have lower cost housing. And just how much lower cost, we have a calculation in this book, we take all of these innovations, we bring it right down to the household level and we say, oh my God, this mythical family called the Hartwicks, they're paying all of this for land, they're paying all of this for mortgage, you know, they're paying this for energy in a leaky house that's emitting carbon. What difference do these things make when you really bring it down to the household level? Well, and we don't have time to go into it all, but let me just say that that between the Jack Cooperative Bank and what we call a community land trust, which essentially takes land out of the market, still allows individuals to own the building, but keeps the land out of the market, creates permanent affordability, and I can go into that more again if you want, and some investment in retrofitting and energy conservation measures at the household level. 20 years, so think about a $330,000 mortgage or $330,000 house, $30,000 down, $300,000. If you take an 8% mortgage, right,
uh-huh,
and you take the fee-based financing, you take the land and deduct the cost, you know, by 45%, which is pretty reasonable, uh-huh, part of a housing price, you put in the energy saving, the Hartwick family in 20 years saves
$483,000.
$483,000. Now think of what that means to the family. Think of what that means to the cost structure that's embedded in our society. And think about where all this compound interest is going. Any guesses?
Think about the financial. It's not going to me, I'll tell you that.
Think about the financial collapse.
Going to homeless people.
Yeah, it's going to homeless people. There you go. You know, it's amazing, right?
So why aren't we doing this?
Well, that's really good question. Well, in fact, the innovation is spreading in each of these areas. Let me just go for a moment and say why, for instance, around community land trusts. So what community land trusts do, they take the land out of the market, they put it in a trust, and the individual or the family, if they're owning it or if it's a rental, the land trust, they have an ownership interest. And there's a resale formula. So the covenant at the heart of getting access to this kind of housing is that the resale formula will be set to ensure permanent affordability. Okay? Now, a place not too far from here, Burlington, Vermont, is where this has been happening for 30 years now, almost 30 years. And I won't go into the whole story, but let me just tell you the impacts. So think about taxpayer-subsidized housing for low-income people, all right? Mm-hmm. So usually there's some kind of subsidy from a federal state and from the state government or a provincial government in our case. Those subsidies flow in, right? And then think about 30 years and think about six or five times that this house sold. Every time it sold, there was cost to the sale, and that individual captured the equity and took it and went on and upgraded. So, this is a very interesting study. $50,000 into that system and $50,000 into a land trust. 30 years later, not another cent of taxpayer money went into the land trust, and it was remained affordable over the 30 years. Look at the subsidy system. It cost taxpayers $872,000 to keep that affordable. That's brain damaged. So, you know, why are people becoming interested? Because there's a crisis of affordability. Where I live, in Vancouver, $780,000 for an average house.
So it really requires a change in mindset. Quit thinking about real estate as an investment and a way of making money, and think about it as a way of sustaining affordability.
That's exactly right. So part of the problem we have is a cultural problem that we're all embedded with, right? So you think about 1960, the average size of a house was 800 square feet in Canada. Today, the size of an average house is 2,000 square feet.
With less people living in it.
Then it was 3.9, now it's 2.6. More people, I mean less people living in bigger space of embedded energy it's taken to create all those granite countertops and this and that. Like, we think it is our entitlement. We are hooked. We've got our own mindsets that are very difficult. The household level, this is very interesting, the European Commission has come to the conclusion that 60% of carbon emissions are related to decisions that are made at the household level. That blows me away. I had no idea.
And it also means we can't solve it with simply, you know, dealing with business emissions.
So at the end of the day, we got these big trends, climate change and peak oil, that are driving us, whether we like it or not. We'd be a lot smarter if we kind of thought ahead and started planning for this rather than keeping our heads in the sand, are going to drive us to recalibrate. We weave our economies on a more local and regional basis, right? And we're not set up for it. And so we have to organize in these basic needs area, but we also have to understand how they're interlinked with each other. Yeah, so essentially, at the end of the day, sea change, we call it sea change, navigating troubled waters in a volatile world. I've been working on this book with the guy with the New Economics Foundation in the UK. We've been around for 40 years in the field, in the trenches, community economic development, social enterprise, co-ops, all this stuff. I tell you, my forehead, I'm sure, is just, you know, it's indented by now because we've had to really do a lot of thinking and research and debate and so on to start trying to make sense of this. And we're not dumb people, but holy cow, it's been hard. So we're pretty excited about this work. It's going to be published by New Society Publishers next May. And I didn't go to any of the conference today because I'm working like mad. We got a deadline of August 1st to try and finish the damn thing. So, I'm pretty stoked. I'm pretty challenged. I worry about my grandchildren. And we've got to do the best we can.
Well, thank you very much, Mike.
Thank you.